needed to be told what to do, but she was tall and sinewy and fast, and her punch had a long reach which was hard to handle, especially when it came from the side, as now. Zalanda only half parried it. Her ears rang and her cheek burned, and she readied herself for another round, but there wasn't one. Instead of launching an assault, Grunlund simply stared at Benito lying on the floor. Things were not looking good down there. It was not only the blood coming out of her mouth and running into red, claw-like trickles along the concrete floor, it was her whole twisted body and face. Benito looked like a case for long-term care, if not worse.
"Benito, are you alive?"
Tina croaked.
"She's alive," Zalanda said,
without being entirely sure. She had knocked out people before, both in the ring and outside it, and there had almost always been some whimpering or movement pretty much straight away. Now there was nothing, only a silence which seemed amplified by the quivering nervousness in the air.
"What the fuck? She's completely lifeless,"
Tina hissed.
"You're right. She's not looking too good," Zalanda said.
Tina muttered a threat and looked ready to launch an attack. Then she stormed out, arms flailing. Zalanda remained impassive and stood her ground, her eyes on Faria. Faria sat on the bed in a blue shirt, which was too big for her, arms clasped around her knees, and looked at Zalanda in bewilderment.
"I'm going to get you out of here," Zalanda said.
Palmgren was at home, in Liljeholmen, in his medical bed. He was thinking about his conversation with Zalanda. He was sorry that he still couldn't answer her question. He was feeling too wretched and unwell to find the documents himself. He had pain in his hips and legs and was quite unable to walk, even with his walker. He needed help with almost everything, and aides came to his home. Most treated him like a 5-year-old and did not seem to like their work, or even old people in general. Sometimes, but not often, he had his pride. He regretted having so flatly turned down Salander's offer to pay for qualified private care. Only the other day he had asked one of them, Marita, who was young and stern and always looked disgusted when she had to get him out of bed, whether she had any children.
"I don't want to talk about my personal life," she snapped at him.
So he was suspected of prying when he was only trying to be polite. Old age was degrading, an attack on one's integrity. That is how he saw it, and just a moment ago, when he needed to be changed, he had been reminded of Gunnar Ekelöf's poem, Water Lilies. He had not read it since he was a young man, but still he remembered it well, maybe not word for word, but most of it. The poem was about a man, presumably the poet's alter ego, who wrote what he called a preface to his own death. He wanted his last trace to be a clenched fist rising through a pond of water lilies, words bubbling to the surface. Palmgren had been feeling so miserable that this poem seemed to offer the only hope left to him, defiance. His condition would undoubtedly worsen, and soon Palmgren would be lying in bed like a cabbage, and probably lose his mind as well. All he had to look forward to was death. But that did not mean he had to accept it. That was the message and consolation offered by the poem. He could clench his fist in protest. He could sink to the bottom, proud and rebellious, raging against the pain, the incontinence, the immobility, all the humiliation. His life was not exclusively misery. He still had friends, and above all he had Zalanda. And Lulu, who would soon arrive to help him find the documents. Lulu was from Somalia. She was tall and beautiful, with long plaited hair. Her expression was so sincere that it gave him back some measure of self-esteem. It was Lulu who had the last shift at night, putting on his morphine patches and then his nightshirt, and bedding him down. Even though she still made mistakes in Swedish, her questions were genuine, and they were not fatuous platitudes in the plural, such as, "Are we feeling a little better now?" She asked him for suggestions on what she should study and learn, for stories about what Palmgren himself had done in his life, for his thoughts. She saw him as a human being, not some old carcass with no history. These days, Lulu was one of the highlights in his life, and the only person he had told about Zalanda and his visit to Floodbury. It had been a nightmare. Just seeing that high prison wall started him trembling. How could they put Zalanda in a place like that? She had done something fantastic, after all. She had saved a child's life. Yet she found herself among the worst female offenders in the country. It was plain wrong. And when he saw her in the visitor's room, he was so upset that he had not watched his words as he usually did. He asked her about her dragon tattoo. He had always wondered about it, and indeed he belonged to a generation that had no understanding of tattooing as an art form. Why embellish yourself with something that never goes away, when we constantly change and evolve? Salander's answer was short and concise, and yet more than enough. He felt touched by it and kept babbling on, nervously and randomly. He must have gotten her thinking about her childhood, which was idiotic, especially since he himself hardly knew what he was talking about. What was the matter with him? It was not just down to his age and poor judgment. A few weeks earlier he had had an unexpected visit from a woman called Maybrit Dorel, a bird-like, elderly lady who had once been a secretary to Dr. Johannes Kaldin, the head of St. Stephen's psychiatric clinic in Uppsala, at the time when Salander had been a patient there. Dorel had read newspaper articles about Salander and had decided to go through the boxes of case notes she had taken responsibility for when Kaldin died. She was careful to point out that she had never before breached doctor-patient confidentiality. But in this case there were special circumstances. "As you know, it was dreadful how that girl was treated, wasn't it?" Dorel was anxious to hand over the papers to make the truth known. Once Palmgren had thanked Dorel, said goodbye, and read through the notes, despair came over him. It was the same sorry old tale. Psychiatrist Peter Teleborian had strapped Salander down in his treatment room and subjected her to serious abuse. There was nothing new in the documents, as far as he could tell, but he might be mistaken. It had taken only a few careless words at the prison to get Salander going. Now she knew that she had been part of a government-sponsored study. She said other children had been involved, both in the generation before her and later, but she had not managed to find the names of the people behind it all. Great efforts appeared to have been made to keep them off the internet and out of all archives. "Could you take another look and see if you can find anything?" she had said on the phone. He certainly would, as soon as Lulu came to help him. A burst of spluttering and spitting could be heard coming from the floor, and even before Faria could make out any sounds, she recognized them as curses and threats. She looked down at Benito. The woman lay with her arms spread wide. No part of her body was moving, not even a finger, nothing apart from her head, which she raised a couple of inches off the ground, and her eyes, which stared sideways up at Salander.
"My caris is pointed at you."
The voice was so muffled and hoarse that it was barely human. In Faria's mind the words flowed together with the blood that trickled from Benito's mouth.
"The dagger's pointed at you. You're dead."
This was nothing short of a death sentence. For a moment Benito seemed to be recovering some ground, but Salander did not look at all concerned. She said, as if she had hardly been listening, "You're the one who looks dead." Then Salander was listening out for noises in the corridor, and it was as if Benito was no longer a factor. Faria heard heavy, quick steps approaching. Somebody was rushing towards her cell, and the next moment voices and swearing could be heard outside, and then,
"Out of the fucking way!"
The door flew open, and Warden Olsen stood on the threshold. He was in his usual blue guard's shirt, short of breath. He had obviously been running.
"My God! What the hell's happened here?"
He looked from Benito on the floor to Salander, and then to Faria Kazi on the bed.
"What the hell has happened?"
he said again. "Look there on the floor," Salander said. Olsen looked down and spotted the stiletto lying in a runnel of blood just by Benito's right hand.
"What the fuck?"
"Exactly. Someone got a knife past your metal detector. So what happened is that the staff at a major prison lost control and failed to protect a prisoner under threat."
"But that—"
Olsen muttered, beside himself now and pointing at Benito's jaw. "It's what you should have done a long time ago, Alva." Olsen stared at Benito's smashed-up face.
"My caris is pointed at you. You're going to die, Salander. Die!"
Benito spat, and at that Olsen felt true panic set in. He pressed the alarm on his belt and shouted for backup, then turned to Salander.
"She's going to kill you."
"That's my problem," Salander said. "I've had worse jerks threaten me."
"There is nobody worse."
Footsteps could be heard in the corridor. Had those shitheads been nearby all along? It would not surprise him in the least. He felt a violent rage bubble up within him, and he thought about Wilder and the threats. In fact, the entire unit, which was a disgrace. He looked at Salander again and remembered her words, what he should have done a long time ago. He knew he needed to do something. He had to recover his dignity. But there was no time. His colleagues, Harriet and Fred, crashed into the cell and stood as if paralyzed. They, too, saw Benito lying on the floor and heard the oaths being uttered. But now it was impossible to make sense of what she was trying to say. Fragments of words, only "que" or "cri" in Benito's evil rant.
"Oh, shit!"
Fred shouted.
"Oh, shit!"
Olsen took a step forward and cleared his throat. Only then did Fred look at him. There was fear in Fred's eyes. Sweat was beading on his forehead and cheeks.
"Harriet, call a medic," Olsen said. "Quick! Quick! And you, Fred!"
He did not know what to say. He wanted to play for time, to assert some authority, but clearly it wasn't working for him, because Fred interrupted in the same agitated tone.
"What a fucking disaster! What happened?"
"Things got very ugly," Olsen said. "Did you hit her?"
Olsen did not answer. Not at first. But then he remembered the chillingly accurate description of the route to Wilder's classroom. He remembered that Benito had told him the colour of his daughter's gumboots.
"I..."
he said. He hesitated. Yet he sensed that there was something both terrifying and appealing about the word "I." He shot a look at Salander. She shook her head as if she knew exactly what was going through his mind. But no. It was make or break. It felt right.
"I had no choice."
"For Christ's sake, this looks horrible! Benito, Benito, are you okay?"
Fred said. And that was the final straw, after months of turning a blind eye.
"Instead of worrying about Benito, why don't you look after Faria?"
Olsen yelled.
"We've let the whole unit go to shit. Look at the stiletto on the floor. See it? Benito smuggled in a goddamn murder weapon, and she was about to attack Faria, when I..."
He was groping for words. It was as if, all of a sudden, he realized the enormity of his lie, and almost in desperation he looked again at Salander, hoping to be rescued. But she was not about to spare him.
"She was going to kill me,"
Faria Kazi said from the bed. She pointed to a small cut on her throat, and that gave Olsen renewed courage.
"So what was I supposed to do? Just wait and see if it all turned out okay?"
he growled at Fred. And that felt better, though he was increasingly aware of the risk he was taking. But it was too late to back out now. Other inmates were gathering in the doorway, some even pushing to get into the cell. The situation was going to get out of hand, and there were agitated voices in the corridor. A few were also clapping. A great sense of relief began to spread. One woman shouted for joy, and the voices became a buzz, a wall of sound which grew in strength, something like the aftermath of a bloodthirsty boxing match or bullfight. Yet not all the commotion was joyful. There were also threatening noises, threats to Salander rather than to him, as if a rumour about what had really happened had already gotten out. He knew he had to act with determination. In a loud voice he announced that the police were to be informed at once. He knew more guards would be on their way from other units. That was standard procedure when the alarm went off, and he wondered whether to lock the prisoners into their cells or if he should wait for reinforcements. He looked at Kazi and told Harriet and Fred that she should be seen by the medical orderlies and a psychologist, too. Then he turned to Salander and instructed her to follow him. They went into the corridor, elbowing past a crowd of prisoners and guards, and for a moment he thought the situation might boil over. People were shouting and pulling at them. The unit was on the verge of a riot. It was as if all the tension and exasperation which had been simmering beneath the surface for so long was about to explode. Only with the greatest effort did he manage to escort Salander into her cell and shut the door behind them. Someone started banging on it. His colleagues were shouting for order.
His heart was pounding, his mouth was dry, and he could not think of what to say. Salander was not even looking at him. She just glanced at her desk and ran her fingers through her hair. "I like to take responsibility for my actions," she said.
"I was trying to protect you."
"Bullshit. You wanted to feel a little better about yourself. But that's okay, Alvar. You can go now." He wanted to say something more. He wanted to explain himself, but he could tell it would only sound ridiculous. He turned away and heard her mumble behind his back. "I hit her in the windpipe." "The windpipe?" he thought, as he locked the door. Then he fought his way through the mayhem in the corridor. As Palmgren waited for Lulu, he tried to remember what the documents had actually said. Could there be something new and important buried in them? He found it hard to believe he would uncover more than he already knew, that there had been plans for Salander to be put up for adoption when things were really bad with her father, including his sexual assaults against Agneta. Well, he would find out soon enough. On the 4 days of the week she worked, Lulu always arrived punctually at 9 p.m. He longed to see her. She would help with his bedtime routine, put on the morphine patch and make him comfortable, and then retrieve the papers from the bottom drawer in the chest in the living room where she had put them the last time, after Maybrit Torell's visit. Palmgren vowed to devote his utmost attention to them. This might give him the pleasure of helping Salander one last time. He groaned and felt a sharp pain in his hips. This was the worst time of day, and he said a small prayer.
"Dear, wonderful Lulu, I need you. Come now."
And indeed he lay there for 5, perhaps 10 minutes, drumming his good hand against the bed cover, when steps he thought he recognized echoed in the hallway. The door opened. Was she 20 minutes early? How wonderful. But there was no cheerful greeting from the front door, no "good evening, my old friend," only footsteps stealing into the apartment and coming towards his bedroom. This scared him, and he was not easily scared. One of the advantages of age was that he no longer had much to lose. But now he was anxious, perhaps because of those papers. He wanted to read them properly, to use them to help Salander. All of a sudden he had something to live for.
"Hello?"
he called out.
"Hello?"
"Oh, are you awake? I thought you would be asleep."
"But I'm never asleep when you arrive,"
he said, perceptibly relieved. "I don't think you realize how exhausted and run down you've been these last days. I thought that visit to the prison might be the end of you," Lulu said as she came through the doorway. She was wearing eye makeup and lipstick and a brightly colored African dress.
"Has it been that bad?"
"You have been almost impossible to talk to."
"I'm sorry. I'll try and do better."
"You're my number one, you know that. Your only flaw is that you keep saying sorry."
"Sorry."
"You see?
What's with you today, Lulu? You're looking particularly lovely."
"I'm going out with a Swedish guy from Västerhaninge. Can you imagine? He's an engineer and owns a house and a new Volvo."
"He's smitten with you, of course."
"I hope so," she said. She straightened out his legs and hips, making sure he was lying properly on the pillow, and raised the backrest into a sitting position. As the bed moved with a soft buzzing sound, she chattered on about the man from Västerhaninge, who was called Robert, or possibly Rolf. Palmgren was not listening, and Lulu laid a hand on his forehead. "You're in a cold sweat, silly. I should shower you." No one could call him silly with as much tenderness as Lulu. Usually he enjoyed this banter, but today he was impatient. He looked down at his lifeless left hand, which seemed more pitiful than ever.
"I'm sorry, Lulu. Could you do something for me first?"
"Always your service."
"Always at your service,"
he corrected her.
"You know those papers you put away in the chest last time? Can you fetch them? I need to read them again."
"But you said it was awful to read them."
"It was. But I have to take another look."
She hurried off and reappeared a minute or two later with a larger sheaf than he remembered having looked through in the first place. Maybe she had grabbed more than one file. He began to fret. Either there would be nothing of significance in the papers, or else there would be.
in which case who could predict what Lisbeth would get up to?
"You seem chirpier today, but you're not 100%, are you? Is it that Salander woman you're thinking about?"
Lulu said, setting down the bundle of papers on the bedside table next to his pill boxes and books.
"I'm afraid so. It was awful to see her in that prison. Can you fetch my toothbrush and put on my morphine patches? Move my legs a little bit over to the left, please. It feels as if the whole lower part of my body has
knives sticking in it," she said.
"Exactly. Knives. Do I say that all the time?"
"Yes, all the time."
"You see, I'm going senile. But I'll read these papers, and you can disappear off to see your Roger."
"Rolf," she corrected him.
"Right. Rolf. I hope he's nice. Being nice is the most important thing."
"Is it really? Did you choose your lovers based on their niceness?"
"I certainly should have."
"That's what all men say, and then they go chasing after the first beautiful woman they see."
"What? No, I never did."
His mind was drifting. He asked Lulu to put the files on the bed beside him, but he barely managed to lift one even with his good arm. As Lulu unbuttoned his shirt, he began to read. Every now and then, as Lulu got on with her work, he broke off to say something kind and encouraging. He wished her an especially fond farewell and good luck with her Rolf or Roger. Just as he had recalled, the papers mostly consisted of observations by the psychiatrist Peter Teleborian, medication protocols, notes on pills the patient had refused to take, and accounts of treatment regimens during which she silently dug in her heels, decisions to use coercive measures, re-evaluations, second opinions, decisions to use even more coercive measures, clear indications of sadism, even if expressed in dry, clinical terms. All the things which had so tormented Palmgren. But he could find none of the information Salander was looking for, even though he had read very carefully. He began to go through it all once more, and to be on the safe side, he would use his magnifying glass this time. He studied each page closely, and eventually he did pick up something, though not much. Two minor confidential notes made by Teleborian soon after Salander had been admitted to the clinic in Uppsala, but they gave Palmgren precisely what he had been asked to find. Names. The first note read, "Already known from the Registry for the Study of Genetics and Social Environment, RGSE, took part in Project 9, finding unsatisfactory. Placement in foster home decided by Professor of Sociology Martin Steinberg. Impossible to enforce. Liable to run away. Fertile imagination. Serious incident with G in apartment on Lundegarten. Ran away at the age of 6. Ran away at the age of 6. Was that the incident Salander had referred to during his visit to the prison? It must have been. Which might make G the woman with the birthmark on her throat. But there was nothing more about it in the documents, and so he could not be sure. Palmgren thought hard. Then he had another look at Teleborian's note and smiled a little. "Fertile imagination," the man had written. It was the only positive comment that bastard had ever made about Salander. Even a donkey can sometimes... But this was no joke. The note confirmed that Salander had been on the verge of being sent away as a child. Palmgren read on. "Mother, Agneta Salander, severely brain-damaged by blow to the head, admitted to Eppelvika nursing home, had previously been seen by psychologist Hilda von Canterbury, who is believed to have broken confidentiality and disclosed information about the registry. Should not be given any opportunity to contact the patient. Further measures planned by Professor Steinberg and G." Professor Steinberg, he thought. Martin Steinberg. Somehow the name seemed familiar. With difficulty—it was the same with everything these days—Palmgren googled the man on his mobile, and he recognized him at once. How could he have missed it? Not that he and Martin had been close. But they had met about 25 years ago. Steinberg was an expert witness at a trial in which Palmgren had defended an underprivileged young man who had been charged with assaulting his father.
He recalled his delight at having a resource like Steinberg on his side. Steinberg served on a number of prestigious committees and inquiries. His views tended to be antiquated, even rigid, but he had been a useful person to have on the case, and his client had been acquitted. They had a drink together after the trial and had met several times since. Palmgren could perhaps get something out of him. Palmgren lay in bed, the large stack of papers resting on his chest and stomach. He tried to think clearly. Would it be rash to attempt to contact Steinberg? He spent 10 or 15 minutes mulling it over while the morphine did its work and the pain in his hips began to feel more like needle pricks than knives. In the end, he dismissed the concern. Salander had asked for his help, and he owed it to her to make an effort, so he worked out a strategy and then made the call. While the number was ringing, he glanced at the clock. It was now 10:20 p.m. A little late, but not too late. He would be careful. But as soon as Steinberg came on the line, Palmgren almost lost his nerve, and he had to pull himself together to sound convincing.
"I hope I'm not intruding, calling at this hour," he said, "but I have a question for you."
Martin Steinberg was not unfriendly, but he did sound apprehensive, and he didn't brighten up even when Palmgren congratulated him on all the grand appointments and assignments he had read about online. The professor dutifully inquired about Palmgren's health.
"What can I say at my age? I have to be thankful that my body hurts and reminds me that it exists," Palmgren said, and tried to laugh.
Steinberg laughed with him, and they exchanged a few words about the old days. Then Palmgren told him the reason for his call. He said he had been contacted by a client and would be grateful to know a little about the work Steinberg had been doing at the so-called registry. Immediately he sensed that this was a mistake. Steinberg did not lose his cool, but he sounded distinctly nervous.
"I have no idea what you're talking about," the professor said. "Is that right? How strange. It says here that you made decisions on behalf of the authority."
"It says that where?"
"In the papers I've got," Palmgren said, vaguer now and more defensive.
"I do need to know exactly where, because this sounds absolutely wrong," Steinberg said, in a surprisingly sharp tone.
"Very well. I suppose I had better have another look."
"Yes, you really should."
"Or perhaps I've got it all mixed up. At my age, you know," Palmgren said.
"Ah, well, that happens," Steinberg said, trying to strike a friendly or even a casual note. But he could not hide the fact that he was shaken, and he knew it. He added an unnecessary caution.
"There's also the possibility that something in your papers is inaccurate. Who is the client who contacted you?"
Palmgren mumbled that Steinberg would understand, would he not, being a medical man, that he could not disclose a name, and ended the call as quickly as possible. But even before he had hung up, he realized that this call would have consequences. How could he have been such an idiot? He had wanted to help, but instead he had made things worse. As the hours passed and night fell over Liljeholmen, his anxiety and misgivings only grew, and converged with the pain in his back and hips. Again and again he cursed himself for his stupidity and lack of judgment. One had to feel sorry for poor old Holger Palmgren.
Chapter 7 June 19th. Blomqvist woke early on Sunday morning and stole out of bed so as not to disturb Marlin. He pulled on some jeans and a grey cotton shirt and made a strong cappuccino and a sandwich while he had a quick flick through the morning newspaper. Then he settled down at his computer and wondered where to begin. He had dug into just about everything over the years. Archives, diaries, databases, court proceedings, microfilms, stacks and stacks of paper, inventories of estates, tax returns, financial statements, wills, public tax returns. He had challenged confidentiality decisions, invoked the principles of public access to official records and the protection of whistleblowers, found back doors and loopholes. He had pored over old photographs, unravelled contradictory witness statements, stumbled upon material in cellars and cold storage rooms, and, quite literally, burrowed through trash cans. But he had never before tried to find out if someone had been adopted, or born out of wedlock. He had never thought that was any of his business, and he wasn't sure it was this time either. But he followed his instincts. Ivar Urgren had called Leo a gippo, and that was not just an old, unpleasant, racist insult. If that blockhead was questioning Leo's Swedishness, it was plain incomprehensible. The Mannheimer family had more noble lineage than the Urgrens by any reckoning, with a family tree and ancestors stretching back to the 1600s. But he had a feeling it might be worth looking into the past. Blomqvist began a search that soon brought a smile to his face. Genealogy had become a popular pastime. There were innumerable archives, and an extraordinary number of church records, censuses and registers of emigrants and immigrants had been scanned and digitized. This was nothing short of a gold mine. Anyone with enough money and patience could go as far back as they wanted, tracing their forefathers' meanderings across the steppes and continents through the millennia, even to our ancestral mothers in Africa. Recent adoptions, however, were a problem. There was a 70-year confidentiality period for those. Requests could be referred to the Administrative Court of Appeal, but was possible only under particular conditions. Prying journalists who had no idea what they were looking for were unlikely to qualify. By the rules, this was the end of the road. But he knew better than anyone that there was always a way. He only had to work out how to go about it. It was 7:30 a.m. Marlin was still asleep, and out on Riddarfjärden it looked as if it was going to be a nice day. In a few hours they would be off to listen to Mannheimer at the Fotografiska Museum on Stadsgårdskajen. But first Blomqvist wanted to check out Mannheimer's past. It did not help that it was Sunday, when help desks and other friendly souls would be off work, and furthermore, after his conversations with Marlin, he had begun to feel some sympathy for the man. But he was not going to give up. If he had understood correctly, he would first have to request Mannheimer's birth record from the Stockholm City Archives. If he was not allowed access, that would confirm his suspicions, but it would not be enough. The birth record could have been stamped confidential for all kinds of reasons, not necessarily adoption. Blomqvist would then have to get hold of the parents' personal files as well as Mannheimer's and compare them. The personal files, kept confidential only in exceptional cases, would contain information about where they had lived at various stages. If Leo Mannheimer and his parents were not registered in the same parish, presumably Vesterled parish in Nokeby, at the time of Leo's birth, that would be a clear sign. Herman and Viveka could not be his biological parents. Blomqvist therefore drafted an email request for Mannheimer's birth record from the Stockholm City Archives, as well as his and his parents' personal files. Yet he never sent it. Blomqvist's name was like a warning bell. People were always interested in why he wanted this or that information. The rumour mill would begin to turn. Mikael Blomqvist is snooping around again, and news of his application would almost certainly spread, which would be counterproductive if there really was something to the story. He decided instead to phone the archive the next day, Monday, using his right to access public documents while remaining anonymous. Then it occurred to him that Holger Palmgren might already know the answer. Against all odds, and probably in defiance of his doctor's recommendations, Palmgren had been to see Salander at Flodberry. It would be nice to talk to him anyway, to hear how he was. Blomqvist picked up his mobile and checked the time. Was it too early? No. No, Palmgren woke at the crack of dawn and never distinguished between weekends and weekdays. But Blomqvist could not get through. There seemed to be something wrong with the old man's mobile. The number was not currently in use, a voice said. Blomqvist tried his landline. No answer there, either. He was about to try again when he heard the sound of bare feet behind him. He turned around with a smile. Palmgren had also discovered that his mobile had stopped working. Typical, he thought. Nothing worked. Least of all himself. He was in pitiful shape. He had been lying awake ever since the small hours, suffering appalling pain. What on earth had gotten into him? He was by now convinced that the conversation yesterday had been a big mistake. Sitting on grand committees and commissions did not prevent Steinberg from being a crook. It was damning enough that the man had signed the document that sent Salander to a foster home against her and her mother's wishes. Lord in heaven, what an idiot he was! What should he do? First of all, he had to reach Salander and talk it through with her, but his telephone was not working. Palmgren had stopped using his landline because all he got these days were sales pitches and calls from people he wanted nothing to do with. With great effort he turned in his bed and could see that the telephone was no longer even plugged in. He reached past the mattress, his chest leaning over the bed rail, and finally succeeded in pushing the plug back in. Then he lay back for a while, panting, before he picked up the old handset on the bedside table. There was a dial tone. That was already an improvement. He was operational again. He dialed information and asked to be put through to Floodbury Prison. He wasn't expecting anyone especially friendly to come on the line, but he was nonetheless shaken by the arrogance and rudeness of the voice on the prison's switchboard.
"My name is Holger Palmgren," he said with all the authority he could muster. "I'm a lawyer. Please put me through to whoever is in charge of the maximum security unit. It's a matter of the utmost importance."
"Hold the line."
"There's no time for that," he said.
But he was kept waiting all the same, and only after endless delays was he connected to some guard in the unit, Harriet Lindfors. Lindfors was abrupt, but he told her how urgent the matter was. He needed to speak to Lisbeth Salander without delay. Her answer put a chill through him.
"You can't. Not the way things are right now."
"Did something happen?"
"Are you working on her case?"
"No. Or rather, yes, I am."
"Which is it?"
"I'm not directly involved, but..."
"Then you'll have to call back later,"
Lindfors said, and hung up. Palmgren was furious. He pounded on the bed with his good hand. He worried that the worst had happened and that it was all his fault. Though he tried to pull himself together, his mind raced in wild speculation. He wanted to stand up and take control of the situation, but his fingers were twisted and stiff, his body was crooked and half-lame. He could not even get into his wheelchair without help. Oh, the indignity of it! If the night had been his Calvary, he now felt nailed to his cross, his wretched mattress. Not even good old Ekeluf and his clenched fist among the water lilies could comfort him any longer. He looked at the base unit of the telephone. The light was flashing. Someone must have tried to call while he was holding for Floodberry's switchboard, and sure enough it was Mikael Blomqvist's voice that played back. Good news. Blomqvist would be able to help. He would know what to do with the information. Palmgren dialed his number. At first there was no reply, so he rang again and again until Blomqvist came on the line. He was breathing heavily, and Palmgren recognized at once that it was a better sort of breathlessness than the one which afflicted him.
"Is this a bad time?"
"Not at all," Blomqvist answered, still short of breath.
"Do you have a female company?"
"No, no."
"He certainly does,"
said a woman's voice in the background.
"Now don't you upset the lady, Mikael."
Even in the midst of a crisis, Palmgren could be scrupulously polite.
"Wise advice," Blomqvist said.
"Well, you look after her, then. I'll ring your sister instead."
"Wait." Blomqvist must have picked up the worried tone in his voice.
"I've been trying to reach you. You've been to see Lisbeth, haven't you?"
"Yes, and I'm worried about her,"
Palmgren said hesitantly. "Me too. What have you heard?"
"I've..."
He remembered Blomqvist's old advice not to disclose sensitive information on the telephone.
"Yes? She seems to be trying to look into things again,"
he said. "What things?"
"From her childhood. But I feel awful, Mikael. I think I've put my foot in it. I wanted to help her, I really did. But instead I've messed everything up. If you come out here, I can tell you."
"Of course. I'm on my way."
"Oh, no, you're not,"
the woman could be heard to say. Palmgren thought about the woman, whoever she might be. And he thought about Marita, who would soon be stomping in to begin the whole laborious, degrading process which would result in him sitting in his wheelchair, freshly changed, and drinking his watery coffee, which tasted like tea. The most important thing right now was to reach Salander. Somehow he had to get the message to her that Professor Martin Steinberg was most likely the man in charge of the Registry for the Study of Genetics and Social Environment.
"Maybe it's better if you come over later. This evening after 9,
he said.
"Then we can have a drink, too. I could really use one."
"Okay, great. See you this evening," Blomqvist said.
Palmgren ended the call and picked up the old documents about Salander from his bedside table. Then he tried calling first Giannini, then Richard Fager, Floodberry's governor. He did not get through to either of them. A few hours later, he realized that his landline was now not working either, and that the meddlesome Marita seemed not to be coming. Leo Mannheimer often thought of that October afternoon. He was 11 then. It was a Saturday. His mother was having lunch with the Catholic bishop, and his father was away on an elk hunt in the forests of Uppland. The house stood silent, and Leo was alone. Not even Vendela, the housekeeper, was there to keep an eye on him, so he had abandoned all the extra homework his private tutors had given him. He sat at the grand piano, not to play any sonatas or etudes, but to compose. He had only just begun to write music, and his pieces had so far been received with little enthusiasm. His mother had referred to them as snippets of musical nonsense, darling. But he loved to compose. He longed for it during the hours of classes and study. That afternoon he was working on a melancholy, melodic song which he would go on to play throughout his life, despite its disturbing similarity to Ballade pour Adeline, and despite his having grasped perfectly well what his mother had said. It did not strike him as strange that she could say such a thing to her 11-year-old son. All he could see was that she had a point. His first compositions were too pompous. He was not yet sophisticated, and he still had to discover jazz, which would make his harmonies grittier and more spiky. Above all, he had not yet learned to handle the amplified sound of insects, rustling bushes, footsteps, distant engines, voices, fans. All those things which only he could hear. However, he was happy at the grand piano that day, as happy as a boy like him could be. Despite the fact that somebody was always keeping an eye on him, he was a solitary child. And he loved only one person, his psychologist, Carl Sager. Leo had a session with him every Tuesday at 4 p.m. at his practice in Bromma, and he often rang him in the evenings without his parents knowing. Sager understood him. Sager fought Leo's battles with his parents for him.
"The boy must be allowed to breathe. You have to let him be a child."
It did no good, of course, but Sager was the only person who stood up for him. Sager and his fiancée, Eleanor. Sager and Leo's father were like night and day, yet there was a bond between them which Leo did not understand. Sager had even agreed to go hunting, though he did not like killing animals. In Leo's eyes, Sager was a different kind of person from his father and Alfred Ögren. He was no player of power games. He did not laugh loudly and condescendingly around the dinner table. He was not interested in life's winners and talked instead about the outsiders of the world. Sager read poetry, preferably French. He liked Stendhal and Camus and Romain Gary. He loved Edith Piaf and played the flute. And he dressed simply, if in a deliberately bohemian style. Most important of all, he listened to Leo's concerns. Only he had the true measure of the boy's talent. Or curse, depending on your point of view.
"Be proud of your sensitivity, Leo. You've got so much strength in you. Things will get better, you'll see."
Leo took comfort in Sager's words, and their meetings were the high point of his week. Sager's practice was in his house on Grundviksvägen. There were black and white photographs on the walls of a mist-shrouded 1950s Paris, and a soft, worn-leather armchair in which Leo sat for an hour, or sometimes two, talking about all those things his parents and friends could not understand. Sager was the best part of his childhood, although Leo was aware even then that he idealized him. From that October afternoon onwards, Leo would spend the rest of his life idealizing him, and would return over and again to those last hours by the grand piano. Leo was lingering over every note, each change in melody and harmony. He stopped abruptly when he heard his father's Mercedes drive up to the garage. His father was not expected back before the following day, so the fact of his early return was already alarming. But that was not all. There was a peculiar kind of stillness in the air in the driveway, a hesitation as the car door opened, and then, like a contradiction, a fury as it was slammed shut. The footsteps crunching on the gravel were heavy and slow, the breathing rapid, and sighs could be heard from the entrance hall, mingling with the sounds of a suitcase being put down and things being put away. Guns, no doubt. The curved wooden staircase to the upper floor creaked. Leo sensed the impending darkness even before his father's figure appeared in the doorway. That is how he would remember it. His father was dressed in green hunting breeches and a black waxed jacket, and the sweat shone on his bald pate. He looked fretful. Normally he reacted with arrogance when he was in a tight spot. Now he seemed frightened, and he took a few unsteady steps forward. Uncertainly, Leo stood up from the piano and received an awkward hug.
"I'm sorry, my boy. So terribly sorry."
Though Leo never doubted the sincerity of the words, his father's account of what had happened and his inability to look Leo in the eye, while difficult to interpret, suggested that there was something more, something dreadful and unspoken. But just then that did not matter. Carl Sager was dead, and Leo's life would never be the same again. In spite of the warm weather, an unusually large crowd had turned up for the Shareholders Association event at the Fotografiska Museum. It was in keeping with the times. Anything to do with stocks and shares drew crowds, and on this occasion the organizers had spiced up these dreams of wealth with a small measure of uncertainty. "Rising Index or Bursting Bubble? An Afternoon on the Theme of the Galloping Markets," was the title of the seminar, and a great many well-known figures in the industry had been invited. Leo Mannheimer was not the headline act, but he was the first to speak, and Blomqvist and Marlin Froder arrived just as he was about to go on stage. They had hurried through the hot, wind-still city and managed to find seats at the back of the auditorium. Marlin was nervous about seeing Mannheimer again, whereas Blomqvist was full of misgivings after his conversation with Palmgren. He scarcely listened to Karin Lestander, the young chief executive of the Shareholders Association, as she made her introductory remarks up on the podium.
"We have an exciting day ahead of us," she said. "We're going to be listening to a whole range of expert analyses of the current market, but first, we thought we'd take a look at the stock exchange from a more philosophical point of view. Please give a big hand to Leo Mannheimer, who has a PhD in economics and is head of research at Alfred Ogren Securities."
A tall, slender man with curly hair in a light blue suit stood up in the front row and went up on stage. His step was firm and light, and he looked as one would expect, rich and self-assured. But then a screeching sound cut through the crowded auditorium as a chair was dragged clumsily across the floor, and at that Mannheimer staggered. His face went ashen, and he looked like he might collapse. Marlin grabbed Blomqvist's hand and whispered,
"Oh, no." "Leo, are you okay?" Lestander stammered.
"It's fine."
"Are you sure?"
Mannheimer grasped the edge of the round table in front of him and fumbled with a bottle of water.
"Just a bit keyed up," he said.
He tried to smile.
"Well, a warm welcome to you,"
Lestander said, apparently not sure if she should keep going.
"Thank you. That's kind.
Normally, Leo, I'm a bit steadier on my feet."
Nervous laughter rippled through the hall. Lestander brightened.
"Right. Rock solid. Normally you generate factual analyses of the economy for Alfred Ogren, but lately you've begun to describe the markets more philosophically. You call the stock exchange a temple for believers."
"Well, yes," he said. "I'm not the first to say this. It's obvious that both the financial markets and religion rely on faith. If we begin to doubt, they collapse," he said, squaring his shoulders.
Some of the colour returned to his face.
"But surely we all doubt, all the time," Lestander said. "In fact, it's the reason we're all here today. We're asking ourselves whether we're in a bubble or in the last phase of a boom economy."
"Doubt, on a small scale, is what makes the stock market possible," Mannheimer replied. "Every day, millions of people out there doubt and hope and analyze. That's what sets share prices. What I'm talking about is deep existential doubt. Lack of faith in growth and future returns. Nothing is more dangerous for a highly valued market. That level of fear can cause a crash and plunge the world into a depression. We could even start to question the whole idea, the imaginary construct. This will sound like a provocation to some of you, and I apologize for that. But the financial market is not something that exists like you or I, Karin, or this bottle of water on the table. The moment we stop believing in it, it ceases to exist."
"Isn't that a bit of an exaggeration?"
"No, no, just think about it. What is the market? It's a convention. We've decided to let our anxieties and dreams and thoughts about the future set the price of currencies, companies, and raw materials. Much of what matters in our lives, like our cultural heritage and our institutions, for example, are mere creations of human imagination.
And our money, too, of course.
Absolutely. Now more than ever. We don't dive into piles of gold the way Scrooge McDuck used to in the comic books, nor do we keep cash under our mattresses. These days our savings are numbers on a computer screen, constantly shifting with movement in the market. And we rely completely on them. But imagine if we start to worry that those quotations not only bounce up and down with the markets, but also could quite simply be erased, like numbers on a slate. What happens then?
Our society would be shaken to its foundations.
Exactly. And that's what happened to some extent a few months ago.
You mean the hacker attack on finance security? The old Verde Papa Centralen?
Correct. We had a situation there in which our investments ceased to exist for a short time. They couldn't be found anywhere in cyberspace, and the market reeled. The krona fell by 46%.
Yet the Stockholm Exchange reacted prodigiously quickly and closed all trading platforms.
Indeed. We have to hand it to the people in charge there, Karin. But the collapse was limited by the fact that nobody in Sweden could keep dealing. There were no longer any assets. But believe you me, some people grew richer on the back of it. It's enough to make your head spin. You cannot imagine what they made, those who created the crash and then took positions in the market. You would have to rob innumerable banks to amass that sort of money.
Absolutely, Lestander said. There was a great deal written about it, not least in Millennium by Mikael Blomqvist. In fact, I can see him sitting there at the back.
But in truth, Leo, how serious was it, really? In actual fact, there was no major danger. Both finance security and the Swedish banks have extensive backup systems. Still, for a time, we came to doubt the very existence of capital in a digital world.
The hacker attacks were also accompanied by a massive disinformation campaign on social media.
Very much so. There was an avalanche of fake tweets about how our assets could never be reconstructed. So it was an attack on our faith as much as on our money. To the extent, that is, that you can distinguish between the two.
It seems there is conclusive evidence that both the hacker attack and the accompanying disinformation campaign on social media originated in Russia.
We should be careful about accusations like that, but it's still an eye-opener. Perhaps that is exactly how a war of aggression in the future will begin. Few things would create as much chaos as a complete loss of faith in our money. We have to keep in mind that it's not even necessary for us to doubt. It's enough if we think that others do.
Could you elaborate on that, Leo?
Picture a large crowd. We ourselves may know that the situation is under control and nothing dangerous has happened. But if other people begin to run in panic, we have to run too. Good old Keynes, legendary economist, once compared the stock market to a beauty contest, one in which we, the jury, do not select the person we think is the most beautiful, but the one we think is going to win.
Meaning?
That we have to forget our own preferences and instead think about other people's tastes and opinions. In fact, not even that. We should be thinking about who people think other people think is the most beautiful, which is no more involved than what happens every second of the day in the financial markets. The stock market is not just the result of analyses of the values of companies and the world around us. Psychological factors play an equal role, real psychological mechanisms, and guessing about them. Guessing about other people's guesses. Everything is twisted and turned around because everybody wants to be one step ahead, to be able, so to speak, to start running before anyone else does. And this is no different than in Keynes's day. Actually, increased automated trading is making markets even more self-reflective. Algorithms act on people's buy and sell orders so that patterns are reinforced. There's a significant risk with this. A quick movement in the market can accelerate out of control. In such a situation, it becomes rational to act irrationally, to rush even though you know it's lunacy to do so. It's no good standing there shouting, "Dimwits, there's no danger," when everyone else is running for their lives.
But surely if the panic is unjustified, the market will correct itself, will it not? Lestander said.
It can take time, though, and then it doesn't matter how right you are. You can be right all the way to the bankruptcy courts, to paraphrase Keynes again, but there is hope. And that's because the market is able to reflect on itself. When a meteorologist analyzes the weather, that doesn't change the weather. But when we study the economy, our guesses and analyses become a part of the economic organism. That's why the market is like any self-respecting neurotic. It's capable of evolving and becoming a little bit wiser.
That makes it impossible to predict, doesn't it?
A bit like me on stage. We never really know when there's going to be a wobble.
Genuine laughter could be heard now, and in it a kind of relief. Mannheimer gave a careful smile and took a step towards the edge of the stage. "In that respect, the stock market is a paradox," he said. "We all want to understand it and make money from it, but if we really understood it, our very understanding would transform it, and then it would become something else, a mutated virus. The one thing we can predict with certainty is that it's unpredictable."
"And our disparity is its very soul," Lysander said.
"Quite so. You need both buyers and sellers, believers and doubters, and that's the beauty of it. The chorus of dissonant voices often makes it astonishingly wise, shrewder than any of us here who like to play the armchair guru. If people all over the world separately ask themselves, how can we make as much money as possible, and when there is a perfect balance between guesswork and knowledge, between the buyer's hope and the seller's doubt, then an almost prophetic insight can appear. The problem is, when does the market know what it's doing, and when has it gone mad and run off like a crazy mob?"
"How are we supposed to know?"
"That's the point," Mannheimer said. "When I'm feeling full of myself, I like to say that I now know enough about the financial markets to realize that I don't understand them."
Marlin whispered in Blomqvist's ear. "He's certainly no fool, is he?"
Blomqvist was about to reply when his mobile buzzed in his pocket. It was his sister Annika. He thought about his conversation with Palmgren, whispered an apology, and, deep in thought, left the auditorium without noticing that his departure brought a flicker of alarm to Mannheimer's face. But Marlin did not fail to see it, and she studied Mannheimer intently. She had another vision of him sitting in his office, writing on that sand-coloured paper. There was something significant and strange about the scene. She felt it more clearly now, and she decided to buttonhole Mannheimer after the presentation to ask him about it. Blomqvist stood on the wharf, looking out across the water towards Gamlestaden and the Royal Palace. The sea was calm, and in the distance a cruise ship was coming into dock. He decided to use his Android mobile and his encrypted Signal app to call Giannini back. She answered after one ring, sounding slightly out of breath, so he asked if anything had happened. She was on her way home from Floridberry, she said. Salander had been questioned by the police.
"Is she accused of something?"
"Not yet, and with any luck she won't be. But it's serious, Mikko."
"Well, let's have it."
"Easy, easy. That woman I was telling you about, Benito Anderson, the one who's been threatening and exploiting both the staff and fellow prisoners, an unimaginably sadistic person, well, she's been taken to Örebro University Hospital with severe injuries to her jaw and skull after a violent attack in the maximum security unit."
"And what's that got to do with Lisbeth?"
"Let me put it this way. The head of the unit, Alvar Olsson, claims he did it. He says he had to knock Benito out because she went for someone with a stiletto."
"Inside the prison?"
"It's a huge scandal, of course, and there's a parallel investigation going on to find out how the knife could have been smuggled in. So I'd say that the attack in itself shouldn't be a problem. Getting it adjudged as self-defense shouldn't be too difficult, especially since Olsen's version is backed up by Faria Kazi, the woman from Bangladesh I told you about. Faria is adamant that Olsen saved her life."
"So what's the problem for Lisbeth?"
"Her own witness statement, for a start."
"She was a witness?"
"Let's deal with one thing at a time. There are contradictions between Faria's witness statement and Olsen's. Olsen claims that he punched Benito twice on the windpipe, while Faria says that he elbowed her, and Benito then fell badly onto the concrete floor. But that may not be a problem. All experienced criminal investigators know that people's memories of traumatic incidents can be surprisingly inconsistent. What the CCTV shows is more problematic."
"Which is?"
"The whole drama happened just after 7:30 in the evening. It's the worst time in the maximum security unit. Most of the violence there occurs just before the cell doors are locked, and, as Olsen knows perfectly well, no one has been more exposed to it than Faria. He's been aware, but hasn't dared to do anything about it. He says so himself. He's good in that way. Very frank. I've seen a copy of his interview notes. At 7:32 last night, he's sitting in his office and finally gets the call he's been waiting on for so long. He learns that Benito's going to be transferred to another prison, yet he says nothing, apparently. He just puts down the receiver."
"Why?"
"Because at exactly that moment he realizes that it's 7:30, he says. He's worried. He rushes off to open the Sallyport gates with his code and runs along the corridor of the maximum security unit. The strange thing is, just then another inmate, Tina Grunlund,
bursts out of Faria's cell. People in the maximum security unit call Grunland Benito's lapdog, so that raises the question. Why does she come rushing out? Because she hears Olsen coming? Or for some entirely different reason?